Oh hey, didn't see you there. Welcome to Secondary Fermentation, episode number 81. Let's have some fun.
That was exactly what I was going to say.
Dang, son. Didn't even mean to do that one.
The unintentional rhyme.
You know, that's how I live. Just the life of a poet. It's tough. Especially when I go through my haiku phase. People get real confused.
Joe, stop talking in haikus.
Oh, man. I don't even remember the syllable scheme for a haiku.
I believe it's 575.
Okay, 575. Beautiful. It takes some thought, though. I can't just be like, what's a five-syllable word?
Yeah.
Or phrase, you know?
Yeah, it definitely has a lot of intentionality. It's a lot easier just to rhyme than to structure your sentence by a syllable count.
Yeah. But this is Joe.
And this is Nick.
And Lauren is silent. She still has no voice.
Yeah, she's still struggling like, with it.
Yeah. It's when you start smoking two packs a day out of the blue.
Yeah.
Your throat rebels.
I don't know if we made the same joke last week, but the movie Us from Jordan Peele.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She sounds like the lady...
The Tethered.
From the Tethered world.
We talked about it, but I don't know if we talked about it on here.
Yeah, she did.
She really did.
If you've ever seen that, you'll know exactly what we're talking about.
Where they talk like they're breathing inward while talking.
Yeah. What a fun movie that was.
Hands across America. What the hell? Yeah, and they just like sustain themselves off of rabbits, like raw rabbits.
Yeah.
So weird.
I feel like that's not really good for your body.
No, no. But we're here. We're back. We just finished our three-part series on the history of beer, going back to ancient times, up through, you know, medieval industrial revolution, prohibition, and then cracking into the modern days. Speaking of cracking, let's crack a beer.
Speaking of cracking, what's the best mythological sea creature? The Kraken.
The Kraken.
Or, no, there's also the, is it the Kraken whiskey? It's like dark rum or something.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, dark rum, not whiskey. But my favorite Kraken is the Kraken of a beer, of course.
The Kraken of a beer.
Joe fished this out of the fridge, and it's aptly named for this time of year.
Yeah.
Pollen Bomb from High Wire Brewing Company, based in Asheville, but located all over North Carolina. And
yeah.
I think even out of state.
Virginia?
Yeah.
Somewhere?
Yeah, so they were founded by the three, it says brewed in can by the Three Ring Brewing Company in Asheville, but they've got a location in Wilmington. I believe it's in Durham that they have their kind of Raleigh-Durham location, but they also have one or two more.
Yeah, I gotta do this. My curiosity is kicking here.
It is peaked. But yeah, so this Pollen Bomb Hazy IPA is from their neighborhood series. Got a really bright yellow can with some sparkly gold glitter, which kind of gives a nod to the season of pollen. But it's dry hopped with Citra and Strata hops. And we're looking at 7.2% ABV. And they've got a nice little scale on the back here. It's a ribbon that has some... you know, details and characteristics of the beer. Obviously, the ABV is 7.2, but it's leaning pretty high on the hop scale, pretty low on malt character, and a very light color, and 40 IBUs.
They are all over the place.
Is there one in Ohio? Did I make that up?
Yeah. There's North Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, Ohio.
Wow, they've really...
I have no idea.
They've really expanded more than I realized. But without further delay,
crack. There's three in Asheville alone. Yeah, in all those states, there's also multiple locations. So three in Asheville, North Carolina, Birmingham. Charlotte, Cincinnati, Durham, Knoxville, Louisville, Nashville, and Wilmington. It's a lot of tap rooms. And also on their page, it says choose your tap room. just like the old Smash Bros. Choose your tap room.
The music is...
Oh, thank you, sir.
All right.
I bought this beer as the first pool beer of 2024.
We are entering... We're exiting pollen season and entering pool season.
Yeah.
But, yeah, really nice light kind of straw gold color, but I don't know about you. Are you getting a ton of effervescence here? I'm just getting, like, what appears to be a super crisp, bubbly beer.
Yeah.
It looks like there's a lot of carbonation.
Fat color kind of foam. Nice fluffy foam. The aroma on this is real nice. And for a hazy IPA, it's not that hazy, actually. It's got a little bit of haze.
Yeah,
it's not like one of those completely opaque beers, though. It's nice.
Yeah, definitely getting some citrusy, kind of like grapefruit, maybe a little bit of clementine. Nothing too like overly zesty, but like more of the kind of juicy, the grapefruit and orange family. But also a little bit of, like, some other sweetness, too.
Yeah. I feel like I'm getting a touch of resin, but not a ton.
Mmm. Okay. Initial impressions after my first drink is super balanced.
Yeah.
And it didn't say that there was going to be a ton of malt character, but I guess the balance is coming more in just the hops used and the flavors that are in part of there, because I'm not getting one way or the other leaning too far, being overly bitter, but it does have some bitterness, mostly on the back end. I'm getting some, like, bitterness through the retronasal olfaction, just kind of maybe a touch of, that, like, resin, but up front it's really juicy and citrusy.
Yeah, just a good solid beer.
Yeah.
Overall, you know, really enjoyable.
Touch of alcohol flavor, but not aggressive.
No. Definitely just a nice balanced beer. It's got a good balance between hops and yeast and malt. As we say, I'm trying to throw a segue in for our podcast, but it's too early for a segue into our topic for the day because we got to talk about other stuff too. So there's some, you know, beer news on here that I did not know. It's kind of crazy. Tell us more, Nick. Tell us more.
This is kind of breaking news because I just saw this today, but breaking news.
Breaking
news.
We're
going to live to our field reporter. I don't have a good name for a field reporter, but so if you are familiar at all with the Rocky Mount Mills area in North Carolina, of course, Rocky Mount, North Carolina. There is a series of breweries there that kind of collectively are known as the Rocky Mount Mills, along with some other businesses and not all breweries, but some just corporate offices there. So they have Hopfly Brewing Company. They have Koi Pond Brewing Company. They've had a couple that have been in the same building as Hopfly, I think currently occupied by Bright Penny.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the other breweries there, Mythic Brewing Company, just announced today on their social media that they are going to be closing Mythic Brewing.
Wild. That was the old Hopfly space, right? Is that where they were?
Yeah, I think they had like a canning facility there, and they kind of, you know, they've gone through a big evolution. Mythic has been, you know, an entity for 6 years. They said they've rebranded once because they were first known as BDD Brewing, which was their early...
I don't know. That sounds bad for some reason.
Yeah, they. I kind of vaguely remember some of the BDD branding. But
BDD.
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 BDD. Their most recent branding, of course, being Mythic. And I do remember as soon as they opened the Rocky Mount Mills tap room, I've been there a couple times. It's a neat space and, you know, fits in well with the other establishments. But, you know, they didn't provide a lot of details about the why. I'm assuming maybe just the venture kind of had to come to a close financially, maybe. But on a positive note, they did end the message stating that the ownership team of Chaz, Matt, and Squatch, which I can't imagine Squatch is his actual name.
This is my son, Squatch. Baby Squatch.
Squatch, which is short for Sasquatch. They're going to join up with Neuse River Brewing Company, which is in Raleigh. So they will not be out of the beer scene entirely. They will just be closing down the brand that is Mythic Brewing. So if you're in the area and you want to have a kind of a farewell stop, now's your time to get there and visit them. I'm not so sure that we'll be able to go before they close, but they do plan to stick around in the industry. So pretty sad, though, because they were definitely a quality brewery and tap room, and I enjoyed several of their beers. I think they were pretty popular for some of their sour beers, and yeah, just kind of out of the blue, didn't see that one coming.
Yeah, that is pretty crazy, because they expanded. They had, you know, different things, and we've had some of their beers in the pod too, I think.
Yeah, and they they weren't just, you know, local to the Rocky Mountain area. They actually were able to get beers into grocery stores, they said. I think they were in Lowe's stores. So,
oh, yeah.
I mean, they had their products out.
Not Lowe's
in
Home
a
Improvement, Lowe's grocery store, Lowe's food.
Yeah, that's what the problem was. They had them at Lowe's Home Improvement. The wrong
contractors
Lowe's.
Kept getting drunk.
Yeah. But, yeah, so, you know, it seemed like they had been able to kind of grow at a sustainable pace, but who knows what the story is behind that.
Yeah. Speaking of Lowe's Foods, we're getting one in Greenville. Excited for that, because Lowe's Foods usually have the beer den, where you can get a nice little pint of beer.
Just a little pint.
And then go walk around and do a little shopping with your beer, which I hope this one has it. I'd be sad if it didn't.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, they always have the adage that you shouldn't shop hungry, because you'll end up buying a bunch of junk food snacks.
Shouldn't shop drunk.
You shouldn't shop drunk, because you would do the same thing. I know certainly, like, if I've ever had a couple beers and walked over to Food Lion, I'm like, man, all this stuff looks really good, and I just load up on
some tacos. I want some...
A lot of things from the freezer.
Totino's aisle. Party pizzas. Yeah.
Let me get about 2 party pizzas.
And then just leave them in the oven until they're charcoal briquette.
Yeah, they looked like just briquettes that were 50 times the size of a normal briquette, but they were just pure black and hard as a rock.
You can use them as a fire starter.
Yeah. They left permanent square stains on my baking sheet. And more important thing is that the place didn't burn down.
Yes. No longer allowed to cook pizza.
Yep.
Have to use the pizzazz exclusively.
Yeah, the pizzazz will turn off and it dings. So you always know when your pizza's ready.
Yeah. I mean, you know what else turns off and dings? Yeast. There's the transition for this.
Yeah. If you've ever homebrewed, you know that the yeast is done as soon as it dings.
Yeah, exactly. You just go, bing.
Oh, yeast is ready.
Yeast is ready.
You kind of teased this. This is a good idea that you mentioned back in our beer history episodes was, you know, early on, of course, yeast was just not a known factor for beer production. It was certainly there because you don't have fermentation or the conversion of sugars into alcohol without it. And they just didn't know it for thousands of years until... You know, it was finally discovered. It's funny to say it was discovered, because it was always there.
Yeah. They're just like, hey, hang on a second. There's something really small in my beer. Is there something flowing in your beer?
Yeah. And of all people, Louis Pasteur, as we mentioned.
Louis, my boy.
He's known as the one who discovered yeast, and that it is alive, and that it's a microorganism, and the properties that create the delicious and nutritious beverage of beer.
Delicious and nutritious, but only if it's an imperial barrel-aged donut stout.
Tons of residual sugar. Just
so much. Like 600 calories a can.
Oh my, yeah, no kidding.
Perfect. But yeah, I mean, I guess, so we said yeast was discovered, but what is yeast? You know, and it's what makes your beer alive. to a degree, unless you've had a pasteurized beer, which most commercial beers, Louis Pasteur also invented pasteurization, where you just have to heat something up to a specified temperature, around 170 degrees. You can do it various ways. You can do flash pasteurization or longer ones. And then you just leave it there for a set period of time. Kills off all the bacteria. And that way you can have a sealed container of things. A lot of craft beer is not pasteurized because it has some impacts to flavor. The flash pasteurization, less so. But there is still some potential. So that's why you can get a nice exploding can of slushy sours or hazies.
Yeah. If you've ever opened a can and it just immediately fought back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or you can squeeze it and you just feel like this thing's about to burst.
It just feels so
it's
full.
Completely taut. Yeah.
Yeah. But so it's discovered. It's been there. So what is it? It's actually a microorganism and a fungi. It's pretty much everywhere.
We're a couple of fun guys.
We're a couple of fun guys. Also, a great brewery, Fun Guys Brewery. Yeah, in Raleigh. True. But you know, it's a little tiny alive microorganism. It's chilling. It's like, what up? I'm here. And it basically takes sugar, breaks it down, farts out a little alcohol. There you go.
Yeah. So alcohol is just yeast farts.
Basically, or I guess carbon dioxide would be the yeast farts.
Yeah, that's true.
What would the alcohol be? Pee?
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of crazy to think about. You know, we're consuming something that is just a live microorganism, but...
And its byproducts.
Yeah, and the byproducts.
Of its digestion. That's so interesting. But yeah, so it breaks it down. Yeast has always been there, and part of the reason that people didn't know about yeast for a very long time, thousands of years of brewing, is because you left out something with sugar at the right temperature in a wet environment, and it just would spontaneously ferment. And they were like, it's magic.
Yep.
Attributed to deities. And then you just find out it's things that are tiny, tiny, tiny microorganisms.
Yeah. They didn't have microscopes in 5000 BCE in Mesopotamia, mm-hmm. so...
Just their macroscopes.
Go figure.
Okay, their eyes.
Their eyes.
Their eyes.
Never thought about it. Our eyes are macroscopes.
Yeah.
It's a profound statement I've just heard there. But
yeah. I mean, if you've never listened to the podcast before and you didn't know what yeast was, you have an idea kind of what yeast is in general. There's a whole bunch of types of yeast, and that's why it's a different naturally occurring thing. And I mean, there's bread yeast and all sorts of things in other cooking applications, but for brewer's yeast specifically, there's a few types that are the most common, and really the most common is going to be Saccharomyces strains. So you've got, first up, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is ale yeast or top fermenting yeast, which if you ever see a nice fat croissant on top of your beer, it's warmer temperatures. The yeast is kind of in suspension, ferments up from the top, and goes along from there.
Yeah, and then the next most common kind of brewer's yeast of the Saccharomyces strain is the Saccharomyces pastorianus. So as ale yeast is known as a top fermenting, this is known as the bottom fermenting. So this is for your lagers, and if you do or don't know about lagers, they typically need to ferment at much lower temperatures than an ale would. And so you got to have a yeast strain that actually thrives in those kind of colder fermentation temperatures. And the fermentation, you know, occurs kind of at the bottom. And so you don't really see that same kind of activation at the top of the wort container. So those are at a range of about 44 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit or 7 to 15 degrees Celsius, much colder than we're working with an ale yeast. And those were kind of the most common ones for a lot of German styles, you know. And, you know, we hear things about like the Märzen and the March beers and Fest beers. The name became such because they were making those and cellaring them in cold temperatures from March until about September when they broke them out for those festivals. So
yeah, now, they have to ferment for just so much longer too.
Yep, it's a much slower process to, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But yeah, yeast is alive, but it actually, you know, it reacts and it responds and creates the alcohol byproduct at different rates depending on the strain too. So
yeah, and I just want, I was curious, is like, why is it top fermenting? You know, why does that foam come up to the top? And just a quick Google search with Google's AI supported answer says that it's top fermenting yeast. It's because it has a hydrophobic surface, and that causes the flocculated, basically groups of yeast, to stick to carbon dioxide, and then that drags it to the top of the liquid. So basically you get that foam because it's hydrophobic and sticks to that CO2, gets sucked up out of there. Interesting.
Yeah. And kind of likewise with the bottom fermenting yeast, because the yeast activation and all the fermentation is occurring and it's kind of settling down, it drops down to the bottom of the beer, you end up with that clearer, more translucent beer that we're known or we're knowing to see with lager types. And then the other product is that you typically have a lighter, less flavorful beer. Not that lagers can't taste great, but they're just known as kind of a clean beer. The foundation is much more simple and clean as far as a flavor profile compared to ales, where there's just such more variance in the flavors that you get because of the yeast kind of just basically settling out and not being present in the mm-hmm. beer by the time it's done fermenting and, you know, canned or kegged. So by that point, the yeast is kind of out of the picture, whereas in ales, you kind of get some of that yeast still occurring and producing some flavor.
Yeah, and once you start stepping outside of the Saccharomyces family of yeast, you start to get into things that give a little bit more funky flavor. Used not as common as the first two, but I'd say, you know, probably third is Brettanomyces, specifically Brettanomyces bruxellensis. I wonder if that nomenclature comes from, like, Brussels.
Yeah, I was wondering that, too.
Because if you had a lambic, it's mainly Brett fermented from in Brussels. So, curious. It probably is, because I'm pretty sure, like, Bruxelles is Brussels in French or something or other. Let me look this up. I'm curious now.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of hear Brettanomyces more colloquially referred to as Brett. But yeah, it's kind of synonymous with a lot of different sour ales. Just helps produce all of those tart, sour, you know, slightly juicy flavors from the
horse blanket.
Horse blanket, that's a
one really, that always sticks with me.
Yeah, I feel like you know, your Saison or some of those kind of wild beers, they
musty,
a little barnyard
boy
flavor in there.
Love a little barnyard in my liquids that I would drink, you know. Oh, I'm like, this tastes like a barnyard.
Yeah, let me just take a horse blanket and wring it out.
Delicious. And this is gonna be a pretty polarizing flavor. Usually something that you gotta be like, oh, okay, it's got some funk. It's usually funky. Moving on to the next group, we've got bacteria. So actually, instead of using fungi, using bacteria to ferment your beer. This can be done a couple different ways. You know, one of the most common ones you might see is a sour beer that uses lactobacillus to do some of the fermentation, and that creates lactic acid, giving you know, that sour, acidic beer. And there are some that are bacteria just to use to ferment it, but then there's also bacteria-positive yeast where they basically work together with that bacteria to produce certain flavors and to do things. So you can use, like, lacto for kettle souring, a variety of different things in that capacity.
Yeah. So just PSA that some bacteria can be good for beer.
Yeah.
We kind of think of beer and brewing practices as a very sterile process, and you want to eliminate bacteria in most senses of the word. But in some cases, bacteria actually helps produce some really nice flavors
mm-hmm.
and does some really good reactions. But yeah, definitely an interesting concept to introduce to beer. I mean, we were thinking about, like, fungi being introduced, but now we're, like, you know, doing all these different strains of bacteria. So there's obviously a lot of different types of yeast. Those are the most common ones we kind of mm-hmm. mentioned, but there's several different strains. And the reason that people have over time kind of pinpointed different strains, and they've reused them and kind of carried forward strains into different styles, is because there's such different properties and characteristics that each strain of yeast has.
Mm-hmm.
And really the whole point of yeast when it comes to brewing is to aid your final product. And something that I've seen on several of the sites and the articles we read for today's episode is that a lot of brewers will say that brewers don't make the beer. The yeast makes the beer.
Mm-hmm.
The brewers make the wort.
Yeah, pretty much.
But yeah, so ultimately you're looking at a couple different things when you're selecting your yeast. Depending on what style you're brewing, you're looking for things like the attenuation, which is basically the amount of fermentation or the aggressiveness of eating the sugars and creating the alcohol. That's a pretty big one, I think, for determining what kind of beer you're making, because you don't want something that's going to be kind of overly attenuating, and if you're doing something that's like a lighter style, that's a low ABV.
Well, I mean, you don't want to have a beer that's... and then conversely, you don't want to have something that's a lot of residual sugars. So if you have a low attenuating yeast, you'll have a lot of leftover sugars. So if you think about like the brewing terms, like original gravity, final gravity, like that original gravity of the wort is like, what's the specific gravity of the wort prior to fermentation, which is just a measure of the, you know, amount of sugars and other things in affecting the specific gravity of the wort. But then as the yeast converts that into alcohol, your specific gravity drops down, you get to your final gravity. So the higher your yeast attenuation is, the lower your final gravity is going to be. And then, like Nick said, that basically is used to calculate your alcohol by volume from that standpoint. So
yeah, which is such the modern approach to measuring that now is so much better than it was back when it was kind of like, there was hydrometer, there was no way to like even measure starting gravity, and they didn't know yeast at all and what it did. And so there's no way to even predict what or how boozy a beer would be. And granted, those beers at the time, the more ancient kind of medieval beers, were not high ABV anyway. Just based on the yeast strains that we know that were present at the time for those styles.
If you want to learn when the hydrometer was invented, visit part two of our beer history series. You got to go back. Give you a hint, it was the same time as the thermometer.
So another thing that's a important characteristic to know about the yeast strain is its tolerance to alcohol. And so basically you need to know how much alcohol the yeast can sustain before it's no longer active. Because you really want to make sure that the yeast is active as long as possible during fermentation, and also to know basically when it's going to go to sleep, because at some point yeast does go to sleep. It is a live organism. And so as the alcohol content rises, it will begin to just kind of fall out of activity and just stop fermenting entirely. And so you need to know, like, all right, if I need to get to a certain ABV, I need to have a yeast that can tolerate the higher alcohol content and ferment for longer and continue to eat the sugar and get to that ABV you're seeking. So
basically they just get so drunk that their biological processes stop.
Hey, when we all have too many beers, we go to sleep.
They're like, hold on, I got to slow down here. This is getting a little too strong for me. I'm going to go take a little nap.
Close my eyes for a minute.
I'm going to rest at the bottom of this fermenter here real quick.
Go to Sweepy.
No Sweepy boys.
And kind of a similar concept for that is the characteristic of flocculation.
Breathing.
Every time we say flocculation, I just want to start singing.
Papa Roach.
Papa Roach, yeah. So when yeast is in the ferment or in the wort and it's kind of active and it's feeding, the term flocculation is when it starts to clump and create these flocks. And then when that occurs, that ferment, it sort of drops down into the bottom of the wort. And so with higher flocculation, you're going to have something that's more of a clear beer, less of a hazy beer. So if you want something like a hazy IPA, it's going to be low flocculation because it's going to be a lot of suspended yeast still in the beer, kind of taking away from the clarity of the final product. And so that's something, you know, they have measurements of kind of low, medium, or high flocculation. And you want to be aware of that particular strain if it's going to be on either end of that spectrum, because if you do want a clear beer, you want a beer that has high flocculation and it's going to drop out and not be suspended in the wort as fermentation gets to an end.
Yeah, fun fact is that high flocculation yeasts actually have a little tiny shepherd in there that tends to the flocks and brings them all in and brings them to the bottom. So
I thought this was a real fact. I'm like,
okay, makes sense.
Shepherd.
Hold on.
Hold on now.
The flocks of yeast.
Yeah, when you pour your yeast into the wort, you're like, yeah, there's a little guy there with a staff and a sheepdog, and he's
leave
like,
leave my herd alone. Leave my flock alone.
Hey, I'm going to round you up here.
I'm going to round you up.
Yeah, so a couple of last ones here. With each type of yeast strain, there's different temperature ranges for which it'll thrive and be active. Again, we have kind of the top fermenting, the bottom fermenting yeast strains where it needs to be in the right range in order to be active and, eat the sugar and create the alcohol. Otherwise, there's also a risk of if you put a yeast in a wort that's at a temperature that's way too warm, you might get off flavors. And that's another issue that we haven't really talked about as of yet in this episode, but we also have a whole episode about off flavors if you're interested in kind of going down that rabbit hole. But one way that can occur, having an off flavor in a beer, is if the yeast is not in the optimal temperature range when it's fermenting. So just making sure that you're keeping that, especially if you're home brewing and you've got a yeast, do your research, find out what that range is, and make sure that you're keeping your carboy or wherever you're fermenting it. Make sure that it's in the right temperature range, because it's really easy to have it too warm, and then it's just it's not going to ferment correctly. It's also going to have really nasty flavors potentially coming off of that. So you got to really look out for that. And really, then the last thing is just like the flavor profile. So again, we talked about just recently the off flavors. Well, we want to have good flavors from yeast, and we maybe don't always think about yeast as being a contributor to flavor, but it's not just up to the malt and the hops to create the flavors you get in a beer. It's also really widely contributed by the yeast. And so, maybe not so much with your bottom fermenting, the lager yeast, they don't maybe produce as much flavor contributions, but certainly with your ale yeast and some of the sour ones with Brettanomyces, that's creating a lot of flavor from and during fermentation. And so you don't want to put a yeast strain that's going to maybe add a flavor profile that's kind of contradictory or doesn't complement, the hops that you're using. For example, there's a lot of science that goes behind pairing a good hop or hop mix with a yeast strain in order to optimize flavor. So
You don't want to make like a Czech pils that's loaded with, Hefeweizen and yeast or something.
Oh, gosh.
Hang on a second.
People kind of experiment a little bit and you kind of cross different styles, and you'll see, I think especially with like pale ales and IPAs now, it's
IPLs, cool IPAs, like just basically messing with temperatures and using different applications for yeast and whatnot. But a lot of things that go into the yeast flavor profile, starting with the obvious, I think alcohol is a big one. They make a variety of alcohols. The number one that we're after is ethanol, but they can, make octanol, they can make fusel alcohols, isoamyl alcohol and whatnot. And these all interact with your taste buds to give you different perceptions. You can say, oh, it has like a citrus-like thing, it's got really boozy flavors, or just got like that classic ethanol flavor, which if you ever had some nice plastic bottle vodka that you're probably pretty familiar with. But there's the alcohol creates so many different things. It's not just flavors, but also sensations like warmth and whatnot that gives a bunch of different things, mouthfeel, all sorts of stuff that can impact your beer experience. If you had a 10% example of a certain beer and then a 4%, you probably would have a very big difference in flavor profile. And alcohol is one of the byproducts that we're after and one of the main things with brewing. But, another category that's a really popular one and kind of obvious is some of the esters that yeast can produce. There's, those fruity and floral kind of classic flavors you think of. If you think of an estery beer, you know, you're thinking of like a Weizen or something like that, where you've got a ton of that banana-y type estery flavor.
Yeah, it's Elsie's favorite.
Yeah, Elsie's favorite.
It's not.
Hey, she hates it. But there's several different types of esters. You know, there's fatty acid esters that are like ethyl hexanoate, which can give you some pineapple-like. There's ethyl octanoate, which is apple, kind of can be cognac-like. And then there's other acetates, which is like isoamyl acetate, which is that banana type flavor, and phenyl ethyl acetate, which is rose-like. I don't know if I've ever had a rose-like beer. Like, this tastes of rose hips.
No, I've had some like other kind of floral or like maybe herby ones. Things like juniper, maybe some other kind of floral plants or herbs, but not rose.
Yeah.
Not that I can remember anyway.
Yeah, I'll say also to give a plug, a lot of this flavor information we are getting from a ebook that's Yeast Flavor and Biotransformation Guide. You can download off of Escarpment Laboratories website, which they are a big manufacturer of yeast. So they give you a lot of information, a lot of very scientific information as well, telling you how to control some characteristics to get certain things out of your beer. Very cool. But they also have a lot of comprehensive information. So yeah. It's free to download.
Very comprehensive.
Check it out.
We're only going to cover like a very small snippet of everything that's included in this guide.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's free.
It's free. Free real estate.
It's free hops. There's free yeast information. Free
yeast. Oh, man.
Yeah. I feel like, esters was one of the first things I learned about yeast character as far as like flavor and aroma. I heard people talk about, this is really estery. I first kind of attributed esters to only be like with like Weiss beers or like the kind of wheat styles with that banana like estery flavor. But come to learn more about the wide use of the term esters and all the different attributed aromas and flavors. So not just singular, but kind of that same vein was the next one, which is phenols. And I feel like again with German wheat styles or the Weissbiers.
Or Belgian beers.
Belgian beers, yeah. Like the phenol kind of is that spice character you often get. But it's not specifically just spice in the sense of like, cardamom and clove and things like that. But that was kind of my first introduction to phenols. But yeah, so the phenolic acids that can be a byproduct of yeast, some of the volatile phenols are 4-vinyl guaiacol. That's a tough one, but yeah, you said the Belgian beers, that's a pretty peppery, clovey style of a flavor. And so if you're having a Belgian beer and you get something that's reminiscent of like banana bread, some of that like banana sweetness, but also the kind of like spicy clove, maybe a little bit of like cinnamon, nutmeg, that's all stuff is like considered part of the phenol being imparted in there. So in many beers, this says that this is actually an off flavor. So if you have a phenolic off flavor, typically if you're drinking a style and it has some spice character that's unwelcomed or unexpected, it's probably not intended and it was a defect in that beer, some kind
of
infection.
Why does my sour have a pepper flavor?
Yeah, I mean, you should mostly detect some phenol character in something like a German wheat style or a Belgian style. And it's, really dependent on the type of yeast where it's going to produce that. Mm-hmm. And there's, I think, some really good information on that particular type of, like, the Weizen styles, if you're interested in what kind of yeast strains those are specifically. But, those are kind of a limited profile. Not that you can't find phenolic character in other beers, but just kind of beware and kind of be mindful. Like, does this seem right? I think another one I think of is like winter ales or like some of those kind of winter warmers. They tend to have some spice character, but in those cases, it might often be an adjunct instead of yeast. So. Yeah.
Which I think one thing this article and reading about this topic was good for me to realize is it's kind of the yeast biotransformation of what's already there in the grains. Because I thought, the yeast creates this byproduct, and I thought, I guess just in my head was like, okay, it eats these sugars and then it chemically transforms them and spits them out. But like for this, it's the grain that's used in the malt contains phenolic acids already. And then this yeast, which actually which is kind of funny. This article says that it's a stress protectant against fungi out in the wild, which is funny. So they kind of take advantage of it in this case, but pretty much the yeast takes these phenolic acids and then makes them into a volatile compound that we can then detect and taste. So it's pretty interesting. And speaking of acid, there's also acids that can be contributed to flavor profiles from yeast. And if you didn't know, beer is actually pretty acidic. It's got low pHs. Wort is usually shooting for a lower pH. And as it goes along, the pH drops through fermentation, especially if you're using specialized acid-producing yeast or you're using a souring bacteria like lactobacillus to really drop your pH of your beer. Sometimes people will add like citric acid or other things, which can also be byproducts of yeast, but you can get some other flavors like acetic acid, which is generally not a great flavor to have in your beer, but you can have a low pH acidic beer.
And there actually is a really basic beer. That's the pumpkin spice beer. So your pumpkin spice
that's
lager.
A basic beer. It's like
PSL.
Such
a basic beer.
pH 8.3. Oh, man. And then another one that's really fun is terpenes.
That was a new one for me today, kind of going into this one.
And terpenes are, you know, really those hop, these are like a hop-dependent characteristic. And again, you're talking about yeast biotransformation of compounds that are already within the ingredients. This is a great example of that. Basically, the yeast breaks down these hops, compounds, busts them out, and then makes these terpenes or hop compounds taste much more prominent. You know, you can have more citrusy, you can have more fruity notes, you can have dank notes, and there's a lot of biotransformation characteristics that go on with this. But basically, like, one of the major compounds that's mentioned in this document, as well as geraniol, which basically gets extracted from the hops, gets transformed by the yeast, and then is created into a few different compounds, which are more citrus-focused and fruity-focused, but citronellol, nerol, and linalool. Linalool, I'm going to say how that one is. Probably wrong, but you get a whole bunch of different flavor characteristics out of this. So really, it's an example of the yeast and the hops interfacing. So it makes that selection of yeast and hops just so much more important during the brewing process.
Yeah, definitely. And that comparison reminded me a lot of, you know, something that kind of goes into the next little segment here for yeast fermentation flavors, which is thiols. And, you know, we did an episode when we first kind of heard about the thiolization process and this new wave of brewers trying to maximize thiols in beer.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of like what that was all about. And we heard things like Phantasm powder being introduced to IPAs. And
yeah, call back to a great episode of Phantasm.
What
was the name of the episode?
I feel like it was a great name.
We had one about adjuncts. Those adjuncts or adding junk.
And, yeah,
but
that was
Phantasm
a great
powder was a different one. It was like phantasmic something or other.
Yeah, but yeah, so, you know, thiols, that was what made me think about that comparison there, is just like trying to maximize the already present sort of compounds that are in the other ingredients in your beer by having reaction and kind of a complement to that. And so, you know, certain yeasts are really kind of they're untapping the true potential of the thiol aromas from hops that maybe don't have much flavor imparted.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those kind of less expensive, less potent hops, but yeast can actually kind of open them up a little bit and expand and create a much more pronounced flavor or aroma from those hops or from the malt even. So
yeah,
one thing is, like, you know, I think it's pretty common to try to accomplish that with like a juicy IPA or like a hazy IPA, something, maybe a New England IPA, of course. You're trying to get more of like a tropical, juicy, citrusy beer. And so instead of, you know, trying to find and really overly hop a beer with some of these, you know, kind of exotic hops, it's like you can get some kind of more common, more household, cheaper, available hops and then have certain yeast strains that will then go in and unlock the potential of the thiols. So
yeah, basically bang for your buck.
Yeah, and it's a similar kind of biotransformation process as the terpene. So
yeah, it's kind of just taking what's there, amplifying it, and then modifying a little bit. So a good example here, they have like cis3MH, cis4MMP, which are some flavorless cysteine-bound precursors, compounds that are then transformed by yeast in that process to another compound, 3MH, which has a grapefruit-like flavor. But then the yeast transforms that again, turns it into like a passion fruit guava-type flavor. Ooh. So really enhancing some of that stuff. Just very interesting how these yeast strains are being genetically, you know, kind of modified in that way to basically enhance that activity and really unlock some of those things. So bound versus unbound thiols, basically releasing the potential of those hops beyond what they normally would have.
Yeah. And this article, again, just kind of, besides going into these biotransformation statistics and kind of best practice there, they have a lot of good resources. I guess, you know, if you're interested for future reading, there's ways you can control if you want to reduce some phenolic character. They talk about how you can use different malts as your base. Temperature is a big factor that you can use to reduce some of the things or increase some of the characteristics. So really just a comprehensive article. And it's,
oh, yeah.
It's a free resource that's available on their website. So if you're kind of a science junkie or you really enjoy the science part of brewing, I think this is a really good read. And
yeah,
there's just so much more that we wouldn't have time to cover this in a brief podcast episode, but
no.
I mean, they really kind of break down all the different types of popular brewer's yeast, and you know, how you can maximize the yeast and maximize the ingredients between your malt base and your hops to achieve a certain goal. If you're trying to get one direction or kind of leaning towards a certain product, like they're going to point you in the right way with statistics and with a lot of science. They've done a lot of the research and development for this already.
Yeah. And I think another thing, you know, we don't have enough time in this episode to go through all of this, but if you want to check out, you know, some popular yeast strains, there's a great, basically, database from beermaverick.com. If you go to beermaverick.com/yeast, they have a database of over 430 different yeast strains, as well as a little information of some of the stuff we talked about. Basically, collating all the different companies out there that have their particular yeast strains and the yeast they developed, and then you can click on them, get a bunch of different characteristics, some of the flavor profiles and whatnot, to really learn about them. Because each company has its own, you know, proprietary strain of yeast that has its own unique genetics, because it is a living organism, and they'll go through and, you know, selectively breed out these yeast to make different flavors, and they all have, you know, crazy names and whatnot. But it's just another option when you're trying to figure out what to brew. You can't just be like, I'd like ale yeast, please, and they're like, oh, what kind?
One lager yeast, please.
I'll take your finest beer, please. But yeah, I mean, yeast, a whole new dimension in beer. Not a whole new dimension. I mean, it's in, one that's been around forever, but like really just a lot. If you're talking about science in beer, yeast is really where the science kicks in a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah, because the ingredients for beer were long established, except for the recent discovery that yeast was, you know, a primary component of beer. And so I think it's just because it's in the last, you know, 150 years or so that yeast was a known commodity for beer, that even now, like with the advancements of technology, people are finding ways to adapt, kind of repurpose yeast strains, kind of split them and breed them in different ways, like you said. So I think it's fascinating that there's so much untapped potential for how much yeast can be used to optimize beer. And clearly, you know, some labs like the Escarpment Labs, they're finding ways to do that too, and providing that as a free resource to people that want to dabble at home.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, if you're talking about breweries too, like they spend a lot of money on this stuff because, you know, you think about things like great examples. If you go to New Belgium in Asheville, you can tour their lab, not tour the lab, but you can take a tour that takes you by the lab. Was it New Belgium or was it?
Yeah, New Belgium and Nevada both. Yeah. Invest in that.
I was like, all of a sudden, like, am I wrong here? But that's the longer tour. For some reason, when we did the last tour, we took a shorter tour at New Belgium.
Yeah.
But you can do a longer tour and they take you past that and you can, like, see, like, microbiologists working, propagating those yeast strains. And because if you use the same yeast strain over time, they can genetically mutate and change. So you need to control for some of those factors as well.
Yeah. Because especially if you're a brewery that size, you're trying to produce the same beer for years and years. If you want to taste the same, it's there's going to be some mutations to that original yeast strain unless you make some, you kind of intervene a little bit. So
yeah, so that yeast can say, my grandpappy
he started this brewery. Yeah. Fat tire, that was fat, my grandpappy's invention
on the back of my grandpappy.
Oh, man. Speaking on the back of my grandpappy, let's see what LC picked up for us for LC's pick of the week. I just gave up on all transitions these days.
I think, honestly, if we're just going to lean into it being goofy and, like, just totally non-related, I think it's even better. Yeah. So,
gosh.
LC's grandpappy would have picked this beer.
Yeah.
But
last time you did it, since she's not here, I can do the pouring honors this time.
It'd be a pleasure.
Assume the position.
Wow.
Cracking up a beer.
One for you.
All right. Okay.
Ooh, I poured mine very aggressively.
Took a whiff and it. Ooh, it definitely has a lot of fruity, sour, tart notes just right off the bat. I also like, just from listening, which I don't think I use my ears enough when I'm doing these blind tastings.
Yeah.
Like, it sounded really like crisp and carbonated. But you could hear how rapidly it dissipated, that carbonation kind of
almost like
left.
Can like, of soda pop.
I'd almost guess that there's barely any head left, maybe a little bit of wispy foam on the top, but I feel like I just heard it all escape. And it's not even, I don't hear any more, so I feel like it's not effervescent or still kind of holding onto that carbonation in the body of the beer.
Yeah. The aroma on this, very fruity, very,
yeah, like strawberry, kind of like a
specific
almost
smell. Yeah, it's like I'm having a hard time picking it up. Like I smell it, instant memory, but I can't picture what it is.
Yeah, I'm getting like strawberry lemonade vibes a little bit, but also it's sweet in the sense of like cakey or pastry, or maybe there's just some residual sugar in there, or some lactose that's kind of like milk sugar that's giving me a touch of sweetness besides the
that's
tartness from the fruit.
Because I almost want to say like cheesiness, but it's not cheesy. It's just like that dimension.
Ooh, maybe it's like a strawberry cheesecake.
It could be. Yeah. Taste. Yeah.
Mm.
It does have like, it's the flavor is kind of like that rounded, like it is some sort of like a little bit of graham crackery sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely, I think, easy to say it's a sour, but
yeah,
what kind of sour?
I also wonder like the color of this beer, if it's just going to be like a kind of dull straw color, if it's going to be.
Ooh. Take a peek.
Oh, wow. So it's like grapefruit juice almost.
Yeah, it looks like almost if you had like a tropical juice. You know what I'm saying? Like,
and yeah, no pinkish head at all to speak of. It's just totally gone. But it has a nice mouthfeel. It's pretty light-bodied, and it doesn't have a ton of bite. But it does have a lot of like acidity to it, too. Mm-hmm.
Kind of reminds me of the Hopfly like strawberry cheesecake blenders. Remember that?
That's what I'm kind of wondering, if it's like a blender, because the blenders also have lactose, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think it definitely probably has a little bit of lacto.
So I could see
lactose, not like, well, probably lactobacillus, but yeah. Lactose.
Yeah, I could see it being, yeah, like a strawberry cheesecake blender or
like a strawberry shortcake, something or other.
Yeah.
Not bad, though, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Got to leave some of this for LC. Too bad. All right, is that your final guess?
Yeah. I'm gonna say it's a some kind of like fruited sour.
Yeah. I always have a hard time picking out berry flavors. That's my only worry.
I hope it's strawberry. I'm going to feel so dumb if it's not.
Oh, wow. This is Imperial Berliner Weisse.
Oh, wow.
With dragon fruit, passion fruit, mango, pineapple, pink guava, key lime, tangerine, toasted coconut, marshmallows, and milk sugar.
Milk sugar.
At least we have lactose.
We got one.
Not one strawberry. But man, I think that huge amalgamation of flavors is probably why. Also, like that tropical color. The lime. Like, okay, I can kind of like, if you do it like that, but I think the way these flavors stacked, it was just sweet, tart, a little tropical.
I'm getting a little bit pineapple now that I heard it.
Yeah, it's funny how that changes your perception so much. But this beer is Maximum Florida.
Maximum Florida?
Yeah. Maximum Florida by Westbrook Brewing Company.
Oh, Westbrook.
That's hard to say. Westbrook Brewing Company.
Yeah.
In Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. So interesting. Imperial Berliner Weisse. That's also hard for me to say right now.
Imperial Berliner Weisse.
And where is...
So what does that make it? Like 6%?
Yeah, I know, right? Those are usually not two words that go together. I can't find the ABV on this can.
Yeah, I'm going to look that up because...
I thought they legally had to put it on there.
It's like, let's take a style that's generally around like 3% ABV. Would you say that was called? Is something Florida?
Maximum Florida.
Maximum Florida.
Do you see it on the can here? It's a very pink can, flamingo on it. It got some teal and black.
It is 6% according to Untappd. Ooh, it's a strong Berliner Weisse.
Oh, boy. That's a heavy beer.
Yeah, super fruited sour with dragon fruit, passion fruit, mango, pineapple, pink guava, key lime, tangerine, toasted coconut, marshmallows, and milk sugar. Let's get weird.
Let's go.
They're like, what can we throw into this beer?
But damn, LC, you got us.
Yeah. Well,
sort of.
I'm kind of
halfway there.
I'm kind of disappointed more. I'm not disappointed we didn't guess all that because that's just so much going on. But of all the different,
I know, right?
All the different flavor notes,
we didn't get one.
We landed milk sugar,
and that marshmallow was it. Out of nowhere. Yeah.
But yeah, dragon fruit is a tough one. I feel like didn't you one time guess pink guava? You guessed pink guava from something,
yeah,
didn't
something
you? Or guava?
Yeah.
No, maybe just guava, not the pink variety. But man, passion fruit's always going to be my nemesis.
I know, right? Because I just need to like get a bunch of fruits and be like, this
is
the flavor of
this. I had passion fruit in when we went to the Dominican Republic, because a lot of their drinks, they had passion fruit, like actual fruit blended up in the cocktails. And it was like...
They were just passionate about fruit, actually. Yeah. It wasn't actually any passion fruit. We are very passionate about this fruit.
We just love fruit.
What are you doing with that fruit? Oh, my gosh. But yeah, on that note... What'd you learn today, Nick?
Well, something I learned that we didn't really dive into just because I think for sake of time, it would have been crazy to try to get into the full scope of that article from the Escarpment Labs. But yeah, they had a really cool bit about trying to supercharge your wheat beers. And you know, they talk about the Franco-Belgian styles of wheat beers, and they're just kind of falling by the wayside because it's such an old kind of classic staple in beer. And like Belgian styles, I think in the U.S. particularly, haven't really succeeded super well. We were talking about the monastic breweries and like, you know, the Belgian styles here, and how we had one monastic brewery that was part of the Trappist.
Yeah, and closed shortly.
Organization, and they closed. It's just like, I just don't think it succeeds well. But yeah, the Escarpment Labs people, they were trying to make... kind of like a supercharged wheat beer. And so they have this recipe for using a Saison Maison yeast and adding it to like a wheat beer to make it like more fruity. And so I just feel like there's just so much room to play and kind of take a style that maybe is not in high favor. And it's like, well, let's just modify the yeast and it'll bring out, you know, more of the thiols from the hops and create a different beer that maybe people will be more fond of. And so I learned there's just so much more untapped potential with like different beer styles kind of coming about. I mean, shoot, we even saw an Imperial Berliner Weisse for the first time.
Yeah. Loaded with every fruit known to man, except strawberry.
They may not have a specific case named yet in like a BJCP style guideline, but they're certainly making a name for themselves somehow, and maybe eventually we'll just have a category for all these. But
yeah.
What did you learn?
Man, I just learned that yeast is the key to unlocking the flavor. That's all I'll say.
I need more flavor.
But yeah, I think it's just cool how yeast really breaks down what's there and spits it out in a volatile compound that we can detect instead of its, you know, non-reactive bound state. So it really just not only makes alcohol, but just transforms everything. We talked a little bit about biotransformation when we talked about hop water.
Yeah.
And I think this is kind of the really the case behind it for doing that. So
yeah,
but very cool. Very cool stuff. But if you thought it was very cool stuff, then make sure you leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Hit us up on social meds on Instagram. We are Secondary Fermentation, Facebook, East Carolina Beer and Brewing, website, eastcarolinabeer.com. If you want to send us a nice little email with a letter professing your professing. I was going to say proclaiming and professing, but if you want to either proclaim or profess your love to us, you can write us a nice little letter on to eastcarolinabeer@gmail.com. We're not on Twitter or X or whatever it's called.
But who's on there anymore?
Yeah, come on. Get with the times. What are we, CNN? But thanks and cheers.
Cheers.